Okay, well, I know just a few more people that I am anticipating will arrive, but we, again, don't want to make the prompt suffer for the
tardy.
Not so prompt.
The not so prompt, exactly.
It's your cemetery, right?
We have this handout, which includes bits and pieces of examples we are aware of people with courses, people with curriculum suggestions existing. I think this is Mark and Kevin. Is that correct? In addition to our work,
yeah.
We are at least at the moment. Almost entirely the folks who were in the morning session as well. Kevin, you are a new arriver.
Right. I'm a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh, and I'm also a research scientist at the Learning Research and Development Center. And I teach intellectual property and cyberspace and law to the law students. And every 2 or 3 years, the way it works out, I get to teach an AI and law seminar to a combination of law students and computer science graduate students, which, by the way, I recommend as a way of adding interest.
Yeah.
It's always helpful to have the law students explain what they know to the computer scientists and vice versa, and that translation is very helpful in helping both groups to learn. I'm a member of the Intelligent Systems Program at Pitt, which has PhD students in AI and applications. And I have 3 graduate students now. And I did want to tell you about 2 projects that are interesting. One of the problems of American legal education, I imagine it may also be true in England, is that there is not enough feedback to the law students. In most of the courses, they just have 1 exam at the end, and the feedback that the professor provides on the exam is usually quite minimal. And so I've been trying to institutionalize having some feedback through peer review. So instead of having all of the questions at the final, at the end of the term, I spun off 1 of the questions as a midterm, and the students take it. It's your traditional law school problem, complicated fact situation, and so forth, and they analyze it, but then they submit it to a program, and the program shops it out to 5 peers for review, and I've created a review instrument that they follow in providing some peer review to each other. And of course, I'm grading the same papers, but in a completely independent process. So I'm not seeing their reviews or consulting them before I provide my grades. And one of my graduate students has a project in which we are experimenting with providing structure to the peer review process so that the peer reviewers are focused on identifying particular issues where the author may or may not have provided adequate coverage, and we're experimenting with a couple of different ways of providing this structure. And in addition, since the reviewing is structured, and we know based on the 5 peers' assessments of what the author knows about particular issues, we're able to, we think, take that information and sort of boil it together in a sort of model of the classroom's understanding of the issues, and then providing some feedback to the professor on what they got and what they didn't get, which I think would be a very useful adjunct.
Yes, I take your point that it is sometimes instructive to see what you didn't teach them as well as what they didn't learn.
For sure, And one of the problems with peer review is that the professor is sort of the last to know because he might not be involved in the actual reviewing process. So this keeps the professor in the loop as well. So that's one project. And another project involves a program called Largo. From my studies as Edwina's graduate student at UMass, I've always been interested in Supreme Court oral arguments and the examples of the justices posing hypotheticals to put pressure on the arguments that are being made and to explore the arguments. And I have to confess that I didn't fully understand it when I was a graduate student. I built a program that made hypothetical variations on the problem situation, but the justices are sort of pulling hypotheticals out of thin air, if you will, or from past cases, or from their own imaginings. And I just wanted to model that process. And so finally, I think I have a model of it. The advocate is proposing a rule for deciding the case, and the justices are fashioning hypotheticals to explore the meaning of the rule, to critique it as overbroad or not broad enough, to emphasize conflicts in underlying principles that apply. And then the advocate has to respond to that by maybe distinguishing the hypothetical or maybe modifying the rule to accommodate both the hypothetical and the problem situation. And the argument proceeds. Hmm. And the LARGO program allows students to read the text of an oral argument. We focused it on subject matter that's of interest to first-year courses, like personal jurisdiction cases. And the students can graphically represent the interesting bits of the argument with respect to where the rule is proposed and where the hypothetical comes in and how the advocate responds to the hypothetical. And the program can't generate these arguments or diagrams itself, but it does have an expert system to analyze the diagrams. It knows where the interesting stuff is in the text because the instructor has sort of annotated the text, and it can provide feedback to the students. So they miss something interesting here, or here's a test and a hypothetical and then another version of a test. Maybe there's a linkage between those two. And after the student gets a decent picture of it, it actually can help to the students to reflect on what's happened in that argument and what the significance of the linkages are. We've undertaken two studies with first-year students to see if they're actually learning something from this diagrammatic reconstruction of the examples. In the first study, we had a small number of volunteer first-year students, and in general, we weren't showing learning except for the lower LSAT groups, and they did seem to benefit from it, and we could find a relationship between their use of the help system that the program provides and their performance on the post-test. We needed more N, though, and so I got one of my colleagues to agree to sort of assign it as part of his legal process course. But there they weren't volunteers, they had to do it, and it washed out. We had our big N, but we couldn't show a learning benefit, so we're very discouraged by it. However, we have done statistical analyses of the diagrams and the features of the diagrams that the help system can identify, and we found a relationship between them and LSAT scores. We did an experiment where there were also third-year students who created the diagrams, and then we analyzed them, and the program could tell which were the third-year diagrams and which were the first-year diagrams pretty well. And then finally, I cajoled and paid one of my colleagues to actually grade these diagrams, and I graded them in a blind test, so we didn't know which were the first, which were the third. And we're doing the analysis now to see whether we could tell the differences and whether those differences correspond to things that we think matter about legal argumentation. And so far, all we've been able to show is that at least we agree, so there is inter-rater reliability, at least on the first cases that we've looked at. So that's in process. But we think that this process of reconstructing an argument made by experts can be instructive, and that these particular arguments are unique in that they are working arguments where you see real live human expert reasoners reasoning about rules in real time with hypotheticals, modifying the content of the rule and so forth. I mean, they're really nice examples. And so they're useful, I think, pedagogically, although I haven't the data to show that people are actually learning from it yet.
Thank you.
Just a quick question. How would you show the learning effect?
Well, we have to use pre and post tests.
I see.
And we have to design the pre and post tests because we're interested in assessing how much they're learning about the process of reasoning that's involved. And that's not something that we normally past tests that we did. Yes.
Do we have folks on the phone? Or do we need to get in?
Do we have folks coming by phone? Do we know?
We should.
Do we have? We should make that work. I'm not sure that
that was a vague instruction.
Where is the god? Would you see if MR could come and get that put into place?
Where's our chief geek when we need him?
Yeah, right.
He's got it at the moment. But we'll be back later.
You sense he was in control.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just to come around, on a sort of a one at a time, you know, one sentence basis. We should just by way of reintroducing ourselves. John, I'm
a co-director of the law lab here. That'll do it.
Mark, do you want
to? I'm Mark Mahaly. I'm a comrade in arms of his at Vermont Law School, where I run the environmental program.
Oliver Goodenough, also Vermont and co-director of the law lab.
Jin Koo, fellow here. I should add that I forgot this morning. I also work with CALI, the Center for Computer Assisted Legal Instruction, which is a member organization of almost every law school in the country, plus a smattering of law schools from all over the world.
And Mark Lawrenson with Capstone Practice Systems.
Mark Temin at Foley Hoag here in Boston.
Brock Rutter, a research assistant here at the Berkman Center.
Richard Siskin, visiting from the UK.
Ethan Catch at the University of Massachusetts.
Edwina Rislin, computer science, University of Massachusetts. Did a lecture position here for a while. Always been interested in examples and cases.
Hmm. Well, we are some of us are new to the discussion at this meeting. Some have been through this morning when we spoke a bit about some specific applications. Again, for this afternoon, my set of goals are to look at and some curriculum design and training design questions. The afternoon is really aimed at the question of what do we do in our law schools, what do we do in our non-law school training of lawyers to meet some of the kinds of challenges we heard about this morning, some of the kinds of challenges presented to us at Richard's lecture, what would we do with that? I'm hoping to come out. We've got some bits and pieces on the table. Some of you have already supplied. I would love additional matters that you would be able to contribute. Just to tip our hand, the eventual goal from this, Brock is taking a lead on some of this, is to develop some proposals and some materials that may be presented through the AALS, a kind of what would it look like if we had an LLM? What would it look like if we had a concentration in this kind of work? You know, training lawyers to meet the kinds of challenges we've been discussing and hearing about. John, you have
a... Can I do a slightly deviant perspective on that? I think there's an opportunity to reconceptualize law in institutional innovation. And that's the audience that wouldn't necessarily be lawyers, but people who are doing... I mean, what I'm finding, we're doing a lot of work with some folks at MIT on the Center for the Future of Banking. And so they're very interested in sort of, well, how do you have new kind of mechanism design on an online world? And so people who are trying to figure out how we govern communities, online communities, what are the role of reputation systems? What's dispute resolution? And so what are the mechanisms and how to do, and they're not necessarily practicing lawyers. And so it's sort of a common law, private law perspective within a context.
Some of that is subject matter development as well as teaching, and where you're aiming at outside.
Research is going along with that. You're building a community that's interested in that, and I'm not sure that would lead into the normal law school curriculum.
Again, one of the questions is what about an abnormal law school curriculum that we might think about as
this
well?
This is abnormal. Okay, anyway.
So those are these other folks with some goals to put on the table.
I'm just curious, CALI, which you mentioned, has some of these same goals. I think.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think we have. I would split this into at least two different subheadings, which would be: one is how do we change the subject matter that we teach, and the second is how do we change how we teach. The two are not necessarily the same, and actually how changing how we teach is, seems to be significantly more difficult than changing what we teach, as long as you can disguise what we teach as somehow doctrinal or whatever. It's pretty easy to slip that into the curriculum, but that may not be what we're trying to accomplish here.
I suppose that's what I've been challenging, really, in suggesting that there is a role, maybe it's not, maybe it's an elective, but it seems to me the law school should at least be offering the possibility for law students to find out how law is actually practiced today and might be practiced in the future. I don't think that's fanciful.
Actually, I should add a third thing. Is scholarship is law school scholarship is embarrassingly uninterested in legal practice in a way that medical school and business school are not. It's absurd that we don't study the practice of law here.
Medicine's a great analogy, because in London, for example, we've got great teaching hospitals where you've got leading academic research, and the same professors who are leading that are actually at the same time seeing patients, and they're teaching hospitals as well, so they're teaching students. That it's a fantastic marriage of theory and practice.
Also, you know, in one of your sister schools across the river, the Harvard Medical School revamped its curriculum,
absolutely,
the Pathways program, which is much more team-oriented problem, and that's an interesting, if they can do it.
Well, Strathclyde is incredible, because in Scotland, you're...
Yeah, I'm a professor.
Exactly, so I mean, I don't know if you want to describe what you've
well, done. I mean, I don't know if now's the right time, but it's...
Sure.
I'll have a go anyway. It's a kind of second generation of e-learning, but what they've done, it's less for undergraduates, more for in Scotland, the professional exam. So you've got your law degree, then you need to do a professional exam. That's done within the law schools. And the way they run it in Strathclyde is they divide the year into law firms of four. So every law student is put in a firm of four, and there's a virtual law firm. And they've created, in a very, very broad terms, it's a kind of virtual environment. It's a bit like Second Life, a law world. So they created a village or a town called Ardkulloch, and the guy's written a huge history of it. There's a huge map of it, and in Ardkulloch there's prisons, there's police stations, there's all sorts of law firms. And you actually become a law firm practicing in this area, and your tutor is actually the role, whether that be the judge you're submitting a motion to, or whether or not it be the policeman you're dealing with in relation to, and you actually have to run a series of cases for a year as a group of four of you. And it's fantastic for people. It's fantastic experience of actually the pressures of having to meet time limits and so forth. But hardly any of the students engage, and they all get involved and get very passionate about them.
I've called this Dungeons and Lawyers, because it's a big role playing game.
Yes.
It's a big role playing game.
Fascinating, isn't it?
How you learn? Yeah, exactly.
What happens now in the Harvard curriculum on the sort of the lawyering, the practice?
I mean, there's the clinical practice, right? But the major innovation of socially recently is the subject matter change, which is important. So we have now advancing. We now have a required international law. I have to say, with all due respect to here, you, as I said also about law firms, you're not going to get the incumbents necessarily pushing innovation.
No. This is just a question of fact. What do they do now?
Hello?
So the clinical programs are probably where the biggest practice is being pushed.
Okay. So I wonder, what do they do in the clinical?
They practice, right? I mean, there hasn't been as much in terms of something halfway between practice and doctrinal training, which is what the simulations could do if we had more.
It's all
of
the
that.
Way up.
No, you're already on.
Hello. And the mics are on.
Hi, Oliver.
Hi.
David.
David.
Hello, David. Good to have you back again. So hopefully you're all set here, and we can hear you. Just called in a minute or two ago as well. Yes, I see you.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Being on the other end, it was awful.
This is David Johnson in the ceiling again.
I'm pushing the phone into your ear so you could hear something.
Sorry to interrupt. So you were describing the.
I just say so it's not sitting down watching Laura's giving webcasts is actually immersing yourself in a virtual legal practice. And above all, it encourages people. Just funny, speaking to the chap who heads up, a chap called Paul Mahard the other day, and he's saying he just had one very irate firm in to see him because the other firm had changed the deadlines or had asked for something. It was just a typical kind of legal tactic that one might adopt in resolving disputes. And the interesting thing he was saying was just how passionate, this is nothing to do with getting their marks or assessment, and they were just passionate about getting this problem sorted. And it seems to simulate a level of engagement and a level of involvement in practical legal activity that we find very, very hard to simulate in any other way.
How important is the realistic realization of the virtual village and the police stations and all of that, or could it be sort of abstracted away and nevertheless one would still have a useful
activity? I think it's not vital, but I think it creates an environment that the students are always so impressed that all the work's gone in. It encourages them to be more involved.
Now you have to go allow.
Part of it is that the virtual world of lawyering is actually two-dimensional for a lot of time, right? You're kind of doing emails and documents, and if you can make that seem realistic,
oh, good.
That you're getting an email from the police department or whatever, that is more real than than having a 3D representation of
right.
The police
department.
Sure. Hello, who's just joined us?
It's Boston University, Steve Don Weber.
Is this Don Weber? Don? And we lost David.
Steve. Callie is going to be distributing the technology in the States, and there's going to be a conference on this concurrent with the Callie conference in Colorado. So in terms of what we're talking about here, you could imagine building practice that's more, you can imagine like instead of doing modeling on a traditional law firm, you can have this new kind of law firm as part of the overall experience.
The other comment, I love technology.
Really?
When you say this technology, the same one that
yes.
Paul Mahard is?
Yes.
The...
yes.
Great.
I mean, I believe it's open source, technically
mm-hmm.
speaking,
that's
but,
right.
but it has to be implemented by people who are
if
not
you want
free.
An introduction to Paul, easily that's lovely. He's a great guy.
He spoke at the Suntech.
At Suntech, right. Yeah, that was quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea.
I've taught a class
if you
two
hit,
screens like this.
If you hit
one of the
where
screens
it's calling, call from. If
was
click
focused,
on that,
the camera was focused on
it.
Me,
yeah.
And the other was focused on the
yeah.
class, which was a small
the
class. And it was perfect.
Oh, okay.
It was and like, you could see me clearly, I could see them.
Yeah.
You're close up.
Okay.
That's
hello?
Sorry, hi, Oliver.
Okay. David, you're back on.
Just think of those billable minutes going out the window.
One of the things that has struck me in as a moderate newcomer to some of this has been the fact that programs to look at questions of going back to the subject matter rather than the method side of things, although I think that you're right, they are interconnected, has been that many of programs, including Berkman's, have tended to be about the law of technology.
Right. Sure, right.
And there's that kind of law of technology, and then the First Amendment and the IP aspects and all of those kinds of things. We've been focusing, at least to some degree, on the technology of law end of it, rather. And again, I haven't seen as much activity in that space. There are some people here who have done some of that, but am I just being unaware of things that I should be more aware of, or is that indeed the perception going about?
Well, this is just my perception, which could easily be wrong, but my perception of people who teach those courses is that they are more lawyers than technologists. Therefore, their interest is in the rules.
Technology of,
right. And they do the same thing that they do in other courses, which is take a look at cases and judicial opinions and try to figure out how this opinion is different from that opinion. And they assume that
the impact of these opinions will be forever, like the impact of perhaps of an opinion 75 years ago was. I think that's all just the wrong way of looking at these things, but I think what has happened over the last 15 years is that every law school has somebody who's interested in these topics and has expertise, and there's a lot being published. But the kind of the framework for looking at these things is not much different from the framework in looking at torts or contracts or whatever.
You can look at that as both a shame and an opportunity. The shame is that very few law schools take the future seriously. And the opportunity is it's a great, if there is a relatively small world community of people who take this seriously, is come together and work on it and produce something of interest. In the UK, I think I was saying to you earlier, Oliver, that I get lots of people who are practitioners who are interested in my work, but they want to know what can we do for my firm.
Yeah.
The point I make in my book is that no one you might think who's in the driving seat in the legal profession is thinking more than about 2 or 3 years ahead. You don't get neither of the big professional bodies in England, the Bar Council or the Law Society, have ever articulated a vision of what legal practice might look like in the future. The government that's actually hugely reforming legal services, and for example, the Legal Services Act and private investment and so forth, has no vision of what legal services will look like in the future, nor is the Law Commission. I don't know a law school, legal e-learning is an exception, but it's not really, it's to do with the training and teaching of law. I don't know a law school in England that takes seriously the future of legal services. And I just sometimes think to myself, am I missing the point? The point I keep on making now is we're putting 15,000 English law students through law school every year with no conception of what legal practice is going to be like in 10 years' time. And no one is responsible enough actually to think about it. And it just absolutely flabbergasts me. And that's why I think it's just there's such a pressing need for it to be more than just a couple of people writing books and shouting. The economic conditions are actually accelerating all the effects that I and others have been predicting. But at a place like Berkman, I think I'm more classically associated with the law relating to technology rather than technology's impact on the law.
In the UK, are there any externships of some of these law students at Deloitte, where they're, you know, standardizing and systemizing and packaging and to see that process?
Do law students ever get exposed to that?
Yes.
No. Just entirely, it's a parallel universe. darker moments, it really depresses me, actually. It's just unbelievable. The oil industry is looking 50 years ahead, doing scenario planning for all sorts of eventualities. Almost every profession, they lift their heads up. I mean, most people who run law firms don't think beyond the financial year, generally. Absolutely honest, even the finest firms in the world. It's remarkable.
We may ask our law firm representative if that's is
a bit longer view than that, but not in decades.
Not decades.
Well, there are some interesting clinical programs in law schools that are doing some work in developing expert systems to provide advice to people of moderate means or poor means with respect to landlord-tenant disputes and so forth. There's one at Columbia that's right. Geared toward New York City. There's at least the one at Pitt aspires to do this. They haven't made too much progress in it. But the idea of making those sorts of legal services available to a community in a clinical setting where you could develop an expert system to try and help people to help themselves in this regard has some potential, I think.
Boy, I mean, that sounds like something from out of the past. I mean, years ago, there was
at least
an effort.
Right? History that are useful. I think to answer your question, there is a lot of history and context in this area that's largely invisible. It's kind of dark matter. It's not not visible to the academic establishment. I mean, two quick points. One is, when I was last year in the mid-90s, before I kind of left in exasperation for this school's disinterest in this whole subject matter, I was working with Charlie Nesson to construct the proposal for this new center that eventually became Berkman. And tried to persuade him to embed some technology of law into the DNA of Berkman as opposed to all law of technology.
Right.
And he was totally disinterested, and I failed. But 10 years before that, we had this thing called Project Pericles here at the law school. It was kind of this leading international research project. Edwin was teaching courses for 3 or 4 years on AI.
No, it was a dozen years.
You taught it for a dozen years?
I taught AI and legal reasoning here from 85 to 97.
Wow. We had in addition to Edwin, we had Larry Farmer from BYU teach 3 years in a row a course in which students built systems as part of their educational experience. So it was both the subject matter and the technology.
And I actually had a clinical arm to the seminar after the first or second year where they were just using expert system shells to grow their own just so they'd understand the process. And also to learn the jurisprudential aspects of it too, but you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Larry Farmer's course, I think, is the closest to a precursor to what I saw the proposal was for University of Vermont. And at conferences, he would talk about students who had learned so much from that they'd gone out and created small companies, businesses that produced the firms and made a living out of it.
Same is true of David. Is David still on the call?
David?
Yeah.
Gene was asking about your course.
About basically how you have a basically innovation labs at New York Law School.
Right, and we have a program we call Certificate of Mastery of Law Practice Technology, where we really challenge students to design new systems like a housing court kiosk and so forth. It's basically a tutorial program, and we very carefully did not bring it up for approval to the faculty for credit because we didn't want to have that fight.
Interesting.
And Don, are you there?
Could I ask what sort of technology are you talking about? I'm
he's underwater.
Yeah.
It's a wide range that covers mostly everything on Oliver's list. The best projects involve building or designing systems. That includes expert systems, but also learning about e-discovery software.
And the categorization that I should include Brock explicitly in this. He is the man who's done much of the research and design work here that I take the professorial credit for. Has divided it into various progressive leaps. One being simply the kind of being aware of what's out there in terms of interfacing with law and legal sources and that kind of thing, but then moving on through the kind of digitally assisted drafting of the document assembly style and that kind of thing, and then on finally hopefully to the actual instantiation of the drafting straight into code of some kind. So that's the goal, is to make them comfortable with that, drawing to some degree from Richard's notions of where that those experts will live, where will there be the meta lawyers of the future, and can we help train people into some of that meta lawyering. Again, to repeat, Brock is going to be a meta lawyer next year. He has the contract from the state of Vermont to help set up their document and form system for family law, divorce practice, that kind of thing, aimed at facilitating self-help kinds of approaches, particularly from folks who can't afford bespoke law. What's interesting for hearing is that some of the thrust in the U.S. is that coming out of poverty law style clinics in order to be able to deliver broadly and cheaply, while Richard's experience in the U.K. is it's being driven out by the very high-end law firms as we go.
I'm to be honest, I've been really surprised by your tales of these courses being taught 10 or 15 years ago, which I had, along the lines of teaching toward document assembly and expert systems and things like that. And
I happened just before I just
to prove it.
To prove it. I mean,
were these ideas before their time, or were they not done right, or?
Well, I'd never say they weren't done right.
Done brilliantly. Must have been ideas.
Well, I think there were added administrative needs and goals and mm-hmm. some of these
whims, maybe is a better way.
Well,
some academic whims to allow it to continue, and then
I think there were personalities who thought certain people thought law should break out. And I mean, a lot of this happened under Forenberg, who was really quite forward-thinking.
Plus, there was Don Berman and Carol Hafner at Northeastern Law School, who had a very nice AI and law seminar with a lot of materials. And
Paul Brest at Stanford.
Paul Brest,
Thorne McCarty.
Thorne McCarty. And,
and Don Troutman was very supportive, even though he came out of the more classical.
So this whole flourishing of these kind of activities.
Is this in the late 80s to mid-90s time period you're talking about? Or?
Mid-80s through mid-90s. I mean, one other tale from that period, you know, we kind of noticed that there were other people around the world, little pockets of people doing this work. And there was a graduate student here by the name of Victor Meyer Schoenberger, and he and I concocted this idea of an international conference, and we called it SubTech, where it was a conference on the substantive technology of law. And we gathered people in 1990. Richard was there, and Kevin was there. I'm not sure anybody else. And but that conference, it kind of reminded us that there were 50 people globally who were really into this stuff back in 1990. And the group hasn't really grown much, but it keeps meeting, and there's all this.
Was there a decline in the late 90s?
I'm not sure if it was a decline so much as, you know, just basis. Continued invisibility is the way
maybe
I would put it.
Maybe until this market change happens, that'll really drive it.
I think there was also a gap between the thinking and the technological infrastructure. For instance, my specialty, Kevin's specialty in case-based reasoning, I don't think it's ever really gotten off the ground in a widespread kind of way because they're not off-the-shelf programs that really let you do them in a significant way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the infrastructure to build these things and get them out there, there was a lack of it, and then they became very expensive. And, you know, so it was sort of a technological side of this that didn't foster the getting it out there.
Yeah. The web
the
is helping.
The web has changed that, yes.
A lot of the work that we did in the late 80s was quite removed from legal practice. A lot of the discussions you then had in subtext. So the AI and law work, which, you know, I love, but it was hard ever to get practitioners remotely interested. The subtech work, actually, lots of practitioners would be interested in. It's just they don't know it exists. I'm just trying to compartmentalize what's the role of a law school. I asked the question, first of all, what responsibility do you have to your students in terms of exposing them, and I think a stronger one than one that's completely unfulfilled, and secondly, what kind of research should go on, and thirdly, perhaps, what kind of collaboration between law schools and institutions is appropriate, and a lot of people have just gone their own way. It's not very hard to find a single body of knowledge or a single community. It's all quite, my sense was we were a closer community in the 80s.
Yeah.
The AI and law community in the mid 80s was about probably 100 people who were really into legal problem solving by computers, I suppose. But I just go back, I mean, we were having this meeting at the Berkman Center. The Berkman Center, like the Oxford Internet Institute, its focus tends to be more on the law. But that doesn't mean it's not I mean, if it doesn't happen here, where is it going to happen? But I think it's going to say, because you know, I met with them, but apparently they sometimes reside downstairs, that David Wilkins and Ashish Nanda, whose work overlaps a very great deal with mine in terms of the future of professional firms, they're part of they're less concerned about the technology, but more concerned about the future of law firms. So that's another... There's something to be pulled together, I think.
I think there's a question here as to whether we're trying to do a kind of a radical transformation, almost like a movement, versus incremental changes where we find the convenient nodes that are amenable. So of the things that have been listed, there's kind of different places you can hook efforts into. So where Wilkins has succeeded is kind of shoving that into professional responsibility, right? And so you kind of disguise something as professional responsibility. You disguise things as clinical projects. There's just different places where you can put them, and it might feel very scattered, but then as a result, you don't have to go through the usual battles. But if, on the other hand, our goal is more ambitious and is to actually transform things, then it's a different conversation.
But your work's another element of it, the work you did in training.
That's another
dimension
of it. Right. I had also done, we'd started an online professional development program for the legal aid projects across the country. So professional training and development, CLE, is another kind of hook, mm-hmm. although their business models are so tense that it's sometimes it can be hard. They might be even more resistant to change than law schools.
You know, from a practitioner's point of view, I'm listening to this. I mean, for 25 years, I brought in young lawyers and trained them and dealt with them. And my comrades at the law school, I'm a recent law professor, 4 years, are always wringing their hands and saying, we have to do this or that to teach them. And our attitude was, no, you don't. We'll do that. And there's really two kinds of lacks, of two kinds of things missing from graduates. One is they don't know how to practice law. And I think a lot of law firms just assume that's what we're there for. Then is they don't know anything. That's more painful. And so when you were going through, Richard, you were going through your list of what you'd like to teach. I mean, basically what you're saying to the law schools is, and we see this, we have a 6-unit introductory energy course. And it's 1/3 economics, 1/3 engineering, and 1/3 law, I would say. I don't think it respects disciplines at all. Mm-hmm. But we have to basically teach students how to work with scientists. They have to understand what marginal cost is. They have to understand finance. They have to understand rudimentary risk analysis. They have to understand rudimentary statistics. And you want to add to that, you know, some mm-hmm. common digital tools. You begin to run into a space problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you really
sure.
do.
I don't think I was ever saying, I mean, I think all of these things should be options. I think there's a core curriculum of black letter law and legal theory, as it were, that is quite hard to avoid having.
You think it is
compulsory.
Hard to avoid?
I do think that, but we can discuss that. But what I'm saying is, at my weakest cases, at the very least, a student should have the option to study the kind of things you're talking about.
I don't personally. I hate to tell you, at least in from our, if people want to work in the environmental arena, defined however broadly you want to define it, I don't think those things are optional. To me, they're much less optional than civil procedure. But I have this thing called the bar exam. I mean, I would eliminate civil procedure and trade it off for economics and finance and risk analysis in a minute if I could, but I can't.
That's interesting. That's a great debate to have, actually. I suppose the trouble is that law students and law schools don't know if people are going to be environmental litigators or whatever.
What they're
going to
be.
Yeah.
I mean, we're training, yeah.
But my stuff, I think, is still more generic. I think that exposure to possible futures in the profession and trends, actually not to have a course that allows you exposure to trends in legal practice. Legal
what sort of technical?
You see, I think you may be the severe disadvantage of missing my lecture.
So give me the 2-minute
version. I'll start again. I was talking about two broad things. One,
just give me the restatement.
One was the impact of what I call disruptive technologies, a whole bunch of technologies that are changing the way the laws work. And second is talking about commoditization, how we move from what I call a highly bespoke or highly customized service to standardizing, to systematizing, to packaging, just new ways of working. I'm more dogmatic in my book than I am in real life. I view this as a kind of buffet of things that that are possible. I don't think they're all going to happen, but I do think that there should be serious discussion about these issues, and that if people are devoting their lives to being lawyers and studying law, I think being exposed to how it all might unpack within their career is just a fairly natural, seem to me, the option to offer them. Now, if you take some automatic document assembly, I just think that law students should know about that technology. I think that most law students go right through law school not knowing that there are quite automated ways of drafting documents. And I think that's a sin.
As much as,
sort of like the analog of Maxima. You don't really have to know how to do all the fancy integrals that you spent a year in freshman calculus doing. There's actually kind of a system that will do this for you.
So it's kind of the focus on the technological present, what's presently possible to transform how you can practice now,
and also
the implications for the future. I mean, those are related but separate agendas as far as content.
But even the seminar I did yesterday with the students, the guy who was good in seminar with me, it was just fascinating how the students were so engaged. And his was a different model of our legal business. This idea of essentially having a collection of people. I made an assumption. He was saying that essentially he leases lawyers, and he's got a team of several hundred lawyers that are available for hire, as it were, on a contract basis. And I said to the students, well, I'm assuming that most of you will be less interested in that than going into a big firm. Hands up. And actually, about half of them were interested in that. Now, none of them would ever have known of the very existence of that kind of model. Mm-hmm. Because the model that most people have in their mind, you go into a law firm. Now, this is a business that's growing. It's gone from zero to $50 million in 18 months. Mm-hmm. It's not going away anywhere, and it's been replicated across the world. I just think it's bizarre that law students would never know about this. You're taught that the way that the law is administered is the law.
Wait, are you talking about... I'm hearing two different things from you.
You're hearing one many
is,
more than
well,
two.
Well, one is things. You're saying, I think there's some substantive thing, tools... that are cutting edge, maybe not even cutting edge anymore, mm-hmm. tools that law students should graduate exposed to, or at least
familiar.
A softer view would be the option to be exposed to it. But the second is, you're saying, I also think there should be, as part of a lawyering course or something, students should have a vision of where the legal profession is headed.
Yeah, I'm cynically saying
they should read your book. I'm
slightly tongue in cheek, cynically saying, is it too much to ask that lawyers are exposed to what's actually going on in the legal? The law students are exposed to what's actually going on in the legal profession at the cutting edge. So I think today's cutting edge is something that law students should learn about. I really do. And Dr. Assembly is an example of that, although it's been cutting for 30 years. And then I'm saying, actually, and I don't think it's necessarily compulsory, but for imaginative law students, they might want to be exposed to possible futures as well. Why would they not be?
Yeah, and I think in part of that exposure is learning how to assess the goodness of these tools. Mm. I mean, it's not done by magic, and, you know, some tools are good and have certain strengths, and others have a very sort of a weakness that the vendors might not tell you about. You have to be a smart consumer of those tools, and if you had no experience with the tools or how they work, you're kind of a little naive about them.
Yeah. Well, I find that my students are, and I don't mean this pejoratively in the least, are pretty good discounters of short-term future value of their studies. That I won't say long-term future value, but short-term future value. What is an employer going to be looking for? What are they not going to be looking for? And in some ways, I think it's also a question of either identifying or creating or making them aware of the demand. Is the demand there for students who know exactly the kind of thing that you're talking about? Now Brock, I keep pointing at you, but here's a student who graduated last year, didn't know such things existed, and now has a job doing this. Is there a place in the firm? I've been starting to try and tell my students, by the way, as firms in the next 10 years wake up that they need to be doing this, can you say go to a firm and say, by the way, you should know that not only am I a pretty good traditional lawyer, but I know about document assembly. I've worked with the major programs. I know about programming a little bit, not enough to be a programmer, but enough to help you intelligently with the process that prescient thinker Richard Susskind says is going to happen to you all in the next 5 years.
It depends on the firm. You go to a big firm, they have a dozen people, or maybe three people, depending on how big the firm.
Already in this role, or
depending on the size of the firm. Yeah.
And where did they come from in to get into that role? Are you hiring them?
Not from law firms. I mean, they may have been employed at another law firm, but they're not, and they may have been lawyers, and they decided this was more fun than practicing law, which is something
but
that
it's,
many
but
of
it's
us
not,
understand.
It's not from law school.
But they didn't go to law school in order to do this.
But right. From a small firm, my firm was a small firm, 25. Mm. From our perspective, I think that there was a natural tendency to rely on young people to push us in certain areas. I remember, that's going to be pretty unbelievable, we didn't have a website. And so what? We were plenty busy. And it was the young people who were saying to us, you can't go on like this. And it was the young people who personed the committee. It was the young people who evaluated the vendors and, in fact, pushed us, and quite willingly really pushed us. But it was like all of us relying on our kids to run the computer, or whatever. There was some of that. And I think you're right. In a very large, larger bureaucracy, that might not be the case. But I think this stuff does make people more marketable in the short term.
Would it be a way for one of my Vermont Law School graduates, who you might not necessarily otherwise look to get looked at, if they came in via that kind of route? Would that be a? Would there be a?
No, not really.
Oliver, what percent of your or the other law school's graduates end up at these firms versus at small, even smaller than 25? Because I mean, if you look at practicing lawyers, over half are in
our profile solo is not Harvard's profile. Yes, we have
right. We're more towards that.
Yeah. Well, and so
or government or a lot of government. We have not talked much at all here about government as a consumer of legal services, but you know,
right.
It's
what I'm saying is that, you know, when you go out and hang your own shingle, or you work for two other partners and you're the one associate, it's a very different landscape and a very different thing you're training them for than maybe be a specialist in technology. Yes. In that case, you need to be a generalist, like you're saying, like, where's your website? Where's your Facebook page or whatever, right?
I was just going to say that at Pitt, a surprising number of the graduates end up not being hired by firms, big or small, but end up being contract attorneys. Yep. They're part of the outsource people. And one could imagine that training in this sort of technology would put them in a position to do a more efficient, better job as a contract, and to be able to draw bigger fees more efficiently for that task. I mean, it's empowering in that respect.
And I always talk to people, students who are coming through here, who come to me and they're like, I have this great idea for technology for law, and they're always pitching it as, we're going to sell it to the big firms. And it makes sense to think that way, because, you know, you don't have to make one or two big sales and you've got your cash. But it also is a much more daunting sales proposition in some ways than creating something that's going to transform all those contract lawyers to make their life 20% more efficient. Is the difference between maybe paying off your student loans and not for that month. And so I kind of feel like those are the areas where people are more desperate for the technology.
Yeah.
Well, the marketing is going to be that much more expensive because you're going to be reaching a...
Why'd you do a Salesforce.com kind of model, or the web services model? I mean, that's what Salesforce.com did.
Sure, but then, I mean, then the cost shift to advertise. I mean, you're talking about thousands of little lawyers. How do you reach them all, right? So,
problem with Salesforce.com.
Yep.
I mean, the same problem.
Exactly.
But the benefits were such that it made a huge difference. And if you do a web services model, maybe that hits that segment of the model and you price it correctly.
Yep.
Rather than do this sort of monolithic enterprise direct sale
All I'm suggesting here is we should be expansive about what we mean by the legal profession and the legal market, because it's not just big firms. With all due respect.
What about the independent agenda of tapping into the pedagogical utility of having people build systems as part of a learning experience?
Yeah.
And that's an old theme,
pedagogical
too.
Pedagogical utility.
Yeah. In other words, to have somebody say, learn this tool, whether it's Scratch or HotDocs or an AI engine of some sort, and say, take this little chunk of law, understand it thoroughly enough so you can express it in code, work with it. It just is a way to understand the law.
One of the things we've targeted in that is maybe doing Reg D under the securities regulations as a tidy little system of law.
I didn't mean my interjection to be at all dismissive or pessimistic. It's not going to be something that's going to get you hired. But firms need more people who understand and appreciate the technology and can see the value of it in connection with what Richard is saying and other things. It's just, there's obviously going to be a tendency to continue on the way things were, as long as they're good, and now that they're not so good so far, that's going to be a change. But it needs people who can appreciate what the technology can do.
So it might be an added thing if you've got an interview with somebody and the resume says, by the way, I also know this. You might, oh, okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and then when you get
there's a need, even if there's not a demand. It's kind of what you're saying. Maybe the big firms.
It's an unrecognized,
it's a latent need,
although it's becoming more and more recognized because the economic.
I think that's. I think I really agree with you. I think that when business was good, these added skills would lose irrelevant. But you might find the students coming through with that expertise, it begins to resonate. I think actually we need more people like X for the future of the practice, because things are changing. I mean, with all my big law firm clients, I'm seeing they're recognizing changes afoot. They actually mostly don't really know where to turn. But actually, back to your point, though, I think of all the things I've ever done in life, one of the expert systems I built was probably intellectually the most stimulating. You have to model an area of law you can't be vague and fuzzy. You have to be precise, and the level of analysis is superb. I used to think, and maybe still do, but I used to think that no lawyer should go through law school without building a rule-based system and actually doing some modelling of the law, because you can get away with not being particularly structured your whole law school career, whereas you can't get away with that if you're doing...
Or diagramming arguments is a variant on that.
Right, and it's not just learning the ins and outs of Reg D or something like that. It's learning what isn't there.
Right.
The limitations of the rules. One concept that I didn't see in the proposal was the concept of normalization. The logical ambiguity in the statutory rule. In the AI and Law seminar, it always amazes me. It's a real discovery for the students to realize that we're not very precise about what the scopes of our logical connectors, the ifs, the ands, so that any sentence in our statutes has, as Layman Allen would point out, 180 different interpretations,
right,
just due to the logical ambiguity, not the semantic ambiguity. Mm-hmm. So there are a host of lessons about the limitations of rules to be learned by this process of trying to model the rules. Normalization, semantic ambiguity, the fact that that there are a lot of conditions that are not stated in the rule, like it can't be unconstitutional, it has to be consistent with the division between national and state roles, federalism, all of that is not stated but assumed.
So
conflicts in the rules, and the fact that we're not just reasoning with the rules, we're reasoning about the rules.
Yeah. So especially as more law moves to the digital world, where those historical ambiguities are less acceptable.
Kevin, I may have misheard you, but I think you said the law school lets you teach this course every 3 years.
What inference do you draw from that?
They're doing you a big favor by letting you teach it every 3 years.
Well, that's the way I had to pitch an AI and law seminar to the law school.
So if you had if you wanted to teach it every year, what would they say?
I might try it again, because I sense that now there is a constituency for it. The students, perhaps because of their experience growing up with the web, have an optimism about technology and the law that wasn't always present. And I think that I could actually get more students to participate now.
One of my questions actually is what have enrollments been like when you were teaching here? What were enrollments like?
I had a cap of 20, and I was routinely up in the high teens, like 17, 18, 19, 20. Okay. And when I first did it,
Would have thought that would be a sustaining demand.
Yeah. And, Jim Fornberg said, well, we'll do it every couple of years. And then he would call up in January and say, gee, could you do it again next year? And so every now and then there'd be a gap or something, but it was 8 times in 12 years or something like that.
And it was nicely and steadily enrolled.
And it was interesting. It got some LLM students and a mix of techies and non-techies. And I could go on about it, but I thought it was a good experience. And it not only, and as a side effect, taught them something about technology, but a lot of the students liked it because they were given an opportunity to introspect about legal reasoning in a way.
Right.
Because, this is for 2Ls and 3Ls. And by the time they get to this seminar, they've been at it a while, but they haven't had much chance to sit back and say, gee, what are we really doing?
What's the cognitive reality?
Yeah, what does it mean to reason from case to case? Or what about these rules? What do you do when they bottom out and all this kind of stuff? So it's an interesting forum to sort of bring up those things, as well as learn a little technology and learn a little bit about some favorite area of the law that they had to work up. Well, it was great fun for me, and that's wonderful.
Well, one of the things that's on my list, at any rate, and I don't know whether this is the time to suggest moving to it, is I'd love to get an ideal curriculum. Suppose I was the dean of the hypothetical law school, and I came to this group and I said, we want to start.
And that's HLS.
You're right. That is what it is. But I would want to start. I want an LLM program. You're mentioning LLM reminds me. I want an LLM program in law and technology, and I don't want it to be just law of technology. I want it to be technology of law. I've read a number of books in this room, and I've decided that that they're right, and that this is an opportunity, that the firms are going to be falling all over themselves in 2 years. They don't know about it yet, but we'll convince them of that. What would be that on that list? What would an ideal curriculum look like? We're not having to fight to get it anywhere. Somebody's come and said, do it. What would we do?
Oliver, I have one thought on that. I think it's important for these kinds of courses to challenge students to actually design and build a system. You can give them a survey, but unless they put their hands on and really think through the problems of creating some system that changes a legal process in some way, they won't really get it.
Okay, so you're arguing that there should be a component that is an actual doing of that. Now, would that be satisfied by a system that restated the law, or are you saying something even more than that?
Well, I'm not saying they have to become coders necessarily, but they have to think through the design elements and think about how the facilities of either existing technology or one they might wish into existence can have an impact on a particular kind of legal process.
Oliver, how are you wanting to? Are you wanting to throw down all the ideas and then evaluate?
Yeah, I think if we can do that, if you don't mind, just doing that kind of approach of.
Can I? Technology and dispute resolution, which will be subdivided into impact of technology in the courts, which would include things like electronic disclosure and so forth, and online dispute resolution. So that would be a module.
And the impact on courts, I mean, at least in the U.S., my impression of the ones farthest ahead on this is bankruptcy court, which has become very, very, at least technologically assisted. All filings are PDFs and everything is going in.
But there's also things like electronic presentation of evidence and how it is that
right.
Conventional
e-discovery rules and things like that.
Well, no, I was just thinking of things using like everything from using PowerPoint to present arguments through to virtual reality modeling. There's a lot going on, and it's the kind of stuff that some of you know Fred Lederer, who's done a lot of work in this.
Mm-hmm.
But all I'm responding to, Oliver, if I was imagining an 8-week course, and you're maybe having two hours. I think you give a seminar on this. You give a whole course on this, actually.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's just what I'm hoping to collect in some ways out of this. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some sort of things that are outside of a law school, but if you don't know about them, you might like to have an opportunity to learn. There's computer science. There's something about statistics, economics. If you're interested in biology, I mean, there's these subject matter disciplines that are out there. In around the university, and you should, I think the students should be sort of given encouragement to go pick up something. Now, sure. Some of these courses are taught for people who are not, they're not taught for this clientele, so there's that problem. But I think for computer science, there are courses that are sort of essentially, the computer science for poets type thing.
Right. So that there would be, within a bigger university, one of the things would be, say, by the way, you're allowed, not only allowed, but encouraged to have two or three of your courses.
That's right. But it probably also requires some cooperation and conversation with people in these departments, because you just don't want them to necessarily do the same old.
Right.
For the law students that they do for their own clientele, but I don't think it's an unsolvable thing.
You might then what you might also do is then have a section that was the lawyer section, the lectures, if it was a lecture in section style.
It might vary from year to year. I mean, for instance, if computational biology is going, and genomics and stuff like that is going to be, a subject matter topic of a lot of litigation. Well, that's kind of part of the technology thing, and maybe there's ought to be some subject matter expertise in that, as much as building web applications, So it's kind of a more situated.
So two things on that. Stanford has been building these collaborative,
right,
interdisciplinary simulations where I think it's like a team of 10 law students run through a simulation with a team of 10 engineering students on a patent filing.
It's a great idea.
Or whatever. So that's right, one way to approach this. Yeah. Just a completely different thought is also some way to study the profession itself. Mm-hmm. Empirical research into the practice. Even just the thing I've been kicking around is half as a joke, half real, is do for litigation what statistical analysis is done for fantasy baseball or baseball management, right? So if you concentrate on one area of the law and work with the group of students over the course of a semester to basically deconstruct all the elements of litigation in one particular area and see what the different factors are that would lead to more or less likelihood of success in a particular motion, say, and begin to generate a huge statistical database that probably itself would be sellable as an asset, but also would just create incredible value for the students who are going to get this process of deconstructing the law at a very deep level.
Fantasy baseball might be.
Oh, I think it's a great idea.
It might also be interesting at the level of takeover battles and things like that. You know, who would be your dream team, and then see who plays out. Yeah.
I agree with David that it's important to challenge students to design and build a system, but I also think there's a utility to a survey as a beginner, so that they kind of are sensitized to the issues.
Survey of tools of practice?
Of the tools of practice. To the extent I've done it, it's a survey of AI and law and focusing them on particular issues about reasoning with rules, reasoning with cases, and so forth. And you can make a requirement of the survey course a paper, but where you really push them to start doing some of the modeling of a particular area of law and to start representing the knowledge that's needed. And then they're set up to then actually design a system to implement it. So I do think there's a role for a survey course as a kind of introduction. So
I think there's only two different kinds of survey courses. One is more of a jurisprudential and legal reasoning course, which you use AI as a prism through which to understand.
That's what I've taught.
Which is what I think you're describing.
Yeah.
I agree, that's a critical component. But the other is just,
survey the tools. Just
a practical introduction to the technology and law practice.
Right. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And just saying, these are the things one finds in the contemporary legal workplace and how you can use them responsibly.
One area that comes up in a lot of these things, but also it's not often talked about as a separate area for lawyers, but it's critical to a lot of practice, particularly in big firms, is dealing with large amounts of information, organizing it, using it, and reusing it. But now, even with even infinite amount of information out there on the web, it's all the more interesting. But even aside from that,
legal. A piece of it would be discovery, but only a piece of it would be discovery.
But also factual.
Yeah, but that was
factual
sort of covered.
Research.
Factual research, organizing research, legal research, reusing work product. Bete Noir, a Beverly law firm.
No, it's good.
Right. Are there certain kinds of legal problems that, you know, the technology, like when you said discovery, I was thinking of all the problems of discovery with electronic documents. I mean, there are probably a handful of problems that would bring into focus some of these diverse concerns from the legal side, from the technological side.
Well, I mean, electronic discovery has employed more computer science graduates, I'm sure, than at any other industry in the past 20 years.
An example problem that, you know, for a quarter or something like that, you know, you're trying to understand and make headway on some legal discovery. I mean, you can't help learn about the law. You can't help learn about technology, right?
Right.
You certainly, I mean, electronic discovery would be an important part of any course like this. Because
there's a nice resource out there now, too, from the Trek legal track. They have two databases of documents. The first one that was available had to do with the tobacco litigation, and unfortunately, the header information is machine readable, but most of everything else is not. But this coming year, they're going to make available a set of documents in connection with the Enron litigation, in which most of it is machine readable. And so,
it's the emails, right?
Yeah, you could have an interesting exercise that involves sort of identifying, creating a complaint, creating the request for discovery and pushing it using the tools all the way down into getting into the documents itself.
And the database would provide you with the ability to at least simulate a case
into
this context.
Yes.
Okay. You've got the simulation brand, but you've also got the real practice mode of clinical education.
Right.
Where students are placed into real law practice settings and learning how to use these tools and even build tools for the practice they're engaged in. I had to quickly summarize that, but clinical field work experience that involves building and using tools.
I want to inject one thought, and then I'm afraid I have to sign off. I'm dubious about the viability of simulations because even though I greatly admire what Paul Maharg has done, they take a huge amount of effort to construct. And in my experience, it's easier to point students at a real-world problem and say, figure out how to do a design or make a suggestion that has an impact on something going on in the real world than it is to set something up that's carefully balanced and artificial in a simulation kind of way. So, for example, we have a team this year redesigning the e-rulemaking process for the U.S. government, and they got a chance to do a design and try to sell it to the new administration in a way that would have been extremely difficult to craft as a artificial simulation project. It was obviously much less controlled than a simulation, but all the more realistic for that.
Okay. Thank you, David. John, by the way, we're doing a curricular wish list for an LLM that would be a law of technology, but also technology of law.
Excellent.
And what would it look like if we did such a thing?
I apologize. I got pulled into a meeting with the dean of students on a thing, so I had a job interview.
So it's all right. We understand people have other responsibilities that call to them as the day progresses.
I wanted just to make one policy statement about and responding to David. Within the Harvard Law School, for what it's worth, our clinical programs don't do simulations as a policy matter. We do only real world clients, and that's debatable, of course, but just with if at all you have Harvard Law School in mind.
And it would so be the real world.
Hard rule. It's the David Johnson rule.
I must admit, I teach at Vermont in a program called the General Practice Program, which is a simulation style clinic, and it has pluses and minuses, but it does mean I can control. I can also train people against things which at least aren't real client problems, which at least in the early part of the course is probably a good thing.
I would be having a module on Web 2.0 social networking and its impact for the way that communities of clients come together. And I say that as in my talk, whether it be very large companies wanting to share legal insight right down to citizens and a different way of recording legal experiences.
Right. This follows on, John, one of the interesting things, as you recall from this morning, but that we had the, reiterated that point that the client-based aspect of legal service provision gets a whole new spin through digitization and that kind of communication and opens a different way of thinking about it. If you put that into a law school curriculum, I mean, at one level, maybe we ought to just offer a course called Clients. And that might be a useful thing at a meta level, but a class that was also about what clients, is one of your ideas being that lawyers should actually be leading in that, should be hearing about it? I mean, is there a career track that would be being client lawyers rather than lawyers?
I think one of the interesting things of the research I've done over the years with general counsel is that overwhelmingly they say that lawyers don't listen to them. That lawyers don't listen to clients. And they often say, something which is an even stronger indictment, which they say that law firms don't understand their clients' business. And what they mean with that, I've done some work trying to unpack what that means. It doesn't mean we don't understand the industry or the sector or their figures or anything like that. It means that you don't really know what it's like to sit in the client's seat and be faced with the problems and issues that particular client faces. And the interesting example I often give of this is it's quite common now that, say, a leading partner in a big law firm will be recruited to be the head lawyer in a client company. That happens quite a lot. I've interviewed about half a dozen people who've done that.
And all of them said the same thing. Mm-hmm. And they were flabbergasted when they got in the chair. All the work they had to do, they had no idea that this was the scope of the job, which meant when they were serving them as external law firms, they had no idea what their clients' issues were. And what you say is fascinating, actually. It would be hugely beneficial for law students to hear the client perspective, because not listening to clients starts at law students. Because a very, very few law schools that I know of ever have general counsel in-house lawyers coming in to say what they think. But if it's encouraged in law school by dint of there never being any exposure to clients, to ignore clients, then it's a bad habit early. And it's
a habit that, in a sense, also law professors and legal education perpetuates, because we don't listen to our clients either. We're not even sure who our clients are, whether they're students or the employer, eventual employers of the students, but we habitually do not poll them in the least about what we should be doing.
Because if you spoke to someone, I don't know if any of you know Mark Chandler, who is general counsel of Cisco. His view in the profession is fascinating. You know, here's a guy who's got $125 million budget that he spends on law firms, got lots of innovative ideas, and he's got some great insights into the future of the profession. He's the kind of guy you want teaching 1 week so that lawyers and actually potential lawyers can hear what it's like at the receiving end.
He's sunk up with our program on legal profession downstairs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they know him downstairs, actually. Yeah.
You know, I don't think this is particular. I have to say, this part, I don't think is a new problem. I mean, I think that the whole problem of
how... You solve old problems as well,
isn't yes, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think, but I, what I'm saying is I think it's, I'm sort of discouraged, because it's, I think that a lot of us have known for a long time that one of the most important things about being a lawyer was to learn how to really listen and to go behind what people are saying. Lawyers are trained that words matter, but in fact, words aren't, they're not trained to go behind the words very easily. And also, lawyers aren't trained to tell clients. A lot of lawyers are very flat-footed. You know, they're not trained to tell clients how to get what they want. They're trained to tell them, particularly in the corporate and in the government world, is what you're doing legal or not? They're not trained to say, well, what you really want is this. Here's another way to get it. I mean, there are law firms that are successful law firms merely because they offer that. Merely because they offer that.
So this is something we were playing a lot of catch up in a very different context than legal aid, where the clients are individual and often poor and even...
And inarticulate.
And often inarticulate, so it was a different kind of problem, and sometimes it was a more challenging problem, and we find that we were playing catch up. One of the things, going back to the idea of scholarship that Larry Farmer, who we mentioned earlier, had done, is actually study interviewing and counseling and begin to systematize that, and then has developed technology to kind of help students get through that. So that's at least a promising thing there. Picking up on what you just mentioned, Facebook along the way just before, and one thing I want to mention is that the Iowa College of Law is doing this. One of the kind of entrepreneurial students there is working with their administration to revamp their best practice, their kind of social media guidelines. There's kind of this reaction recently where law schools are saying just don't use. Don't do anything with these things, it's basically like don't use Facebook, don't post your drunken pictures and all that kind of stuff. And her response was, this is stupid because, whether or not the actual technology of Facebook or LinkedIn is going to be the thing we're all going to be using in 5 years, the point is that this is one future way in which we as lawyers are going to be marketing ourselves. And if you're basically saying to students, cut this off, it's antithetical to your professional career rather than supportive of your professional career. You're
you
doing your students
use smart rather than use
yes dumb. Yeah, here's a smart way to do it rather than just ban it outright.
Mm-hmm.
But that comes up against I was being serious and not lighthearted. The attitudes in the mid 90s when I was talking about email, it may look as if email's the plaything of scientists and under 18s, but actually this will dominate the way you work as lawyers. And I simply could not convince the legal profession. And similarly, just now there's the. When I mentioned Facebook amongst top lawyers in right around the world, there's a giggle. it's actually thought to be, oh, yeah, my teenage children use that, but it's not something that's relevant. And I often say it disassociates. Is that the same way as you said? This is not about Facebook or LinkedIn. It's about a new way of communicating that seems to me, hand in heart, to be inevitable. I may be wrong. I think it's unlikely. I actually think 300 million people out there, for starters, is a critical mass. And they, within a very short order, are going to be both clients and legal providers.
Yep.
So why don't we embrace now? It's a big challenge. But this is why I think this could... law schools should be thought leaders rather in this area.
Is there not another element of the Web 2.0, not the just the social networking, but the the 2.0 of the information of XML and similarly tagged standardized information, standard contract clauses, standard spots for watching variables such as cash flow or ratios or whatever area you're in, networked on a Web 2.0 situation. I don't know how to teach that, and it's more of a watch this space, I think.
But I think quite a lot of it's like that. And I'm just saying a module, a week, a two-hour session of Web 2.0, here's what it is, and get the students starting thinking, what could, big question, what, for example, what could lawyers use wiki technology for? And just see the discussion that flows. But in a lot of these, particularly LLM level, one doesn't need to be too didactic. I think one can actually raise technologies with which all these students are familiar, but actually haven't. It's amazing how many law students have never thought that Facebook might be relevant for the business of law.
Has anyone tried to teach this in a lawyering class rather than an AI class? You know, introduction to lawyering, I mean, all those classes. I mean, you know, you could see this kind of stuff being, finding a home in there and woven into it. Has anybody ever done that?
I'm sure some have done it, but I couldn't name them.
No, nor I.
That's where I think it belongs.
So, is that not what we're saying?
Well, there has been in U.S. law school pedagogy a movement that there was this to have a class about what it was to be a lawyer, and it was often called lawyering. I for my sins taught a version of it, and my expression reveals my prejudices, I'm afraid, or my not even prejudices, my retrojudices.
It tends to be a dumping ground for professionalism, a whole host of concepts. Ethics. Well, but then that got pulled out, especially. But a lot of students, if it's it's one of those things, if it's well taught and well conceived, it's brilliant. And if it's not, it's a waste of time.
One of the most celebrated courses at the law school was Albert Sachs's lawyering process, and everybody took it. And it was considered essential.
We used to have it.
What's your name?
Brock.
And you didn't like it.
I think Brock was making a different point than Richards when he was talking about XML. And it seems to me it's important at a separate thing with regard to what can this new technology, what can XML or the semantic web do for us in terms of enabling new ways of actually practicing law and doing things more efficiently.
Well, I mean, two companies that had a financial relationship or something could have tagged and standardized information so that, you know, if one of them knew that the other was insolvent or something by watching these tagged things, then it could stop doing business or demand cash payment, whatever the case may be. And I think there's going to be a web of things like that connecting companies that people will need to be taught to how to do that.
I'll come back and I will write.
The SEC now acquires that sort of
thing. Right? Take two.
Two more.
Okay, great. I was just putting down legal standards and technology, partly because you know, there is this question of are we going to go for standardization? Is there a kind of an ISO or whatever approach to the technology ends of things? So I was just putting that down. But go ahead.
One is just the art and science of drafting, transactional drafting.
Right.
You know, the tools and methodologies the new systems allow. So the other one is legal tech entrepreneurship. Maybe, you know, built up with a business school. Just focusing on the opportunities outside of the conventional legal services delivery system to leverage new techniques to serve the needs of the system.
And that might tie back into some of what has always been my feeling about law students, is if they can see where why they will want to have taken this in 5 years, they're much more likely to have been there than if not.
Drafting is the word you want to talk.
Can I just go back to the standards? Because it does raise interesting questions. And I mentioned in my talk that the construction and engineering industry have developed some very advanced standard forms. Mm-hmm. And that was because for every construction and engineering project, if you start with a blank sheet of paper, the amount you need to negotiate and discuss delays the project by decades. And so, in fact, these standard forms greatly restricted the amount that's by and large negotiated and discussed. There's a movement in the UK to do the same for software development agreements, and in the world of derivatives, that's well established as well. And it's a technique that particular communities adopt. They say that the that legal input should enable and not restrict agreements, and what we should actually do is standardize as much as possible and make it clear what's sensibly commercially negotiable. That whole philosophy is fascinating because it flies in the face of the bespoke tradition that I'm saying dominates many of our thinking about
law. And it also actually could be client driven. I practice law as well, and my relations with clients, I tried to gauge their desire for risk. I tried to gauge their desire to trade, trying to be explicit about the fact I have the 30-page form, I have the 4-page form, I have the 1-page form. What do we want to use in this context? And what levels of protection? Because I can, I did entertainment law. If I'm getting a transfer of rights, I can have a 1-page thing which gives all rights and warrants that they were good and takes care of it. And I've got the 40-page form as well that then goes into all the details and everything else it could have been. I think, by and large, 99.9 times out of 100, it'll hold up just as well if we use the 1-page form. Are you willing to accept that additional piece of risk? If so, I'm a happy man because I can do another deal too. But if not, then we'll go. It's hard, but I think it's also hard for lawyers to and if they're not on good terms with their clients, to be that explicit about what is it you want and what is it you're how much you're willing to accept. Then there's the problem of also signaling to the other side, because if you go in with the 10-page document, do they think you're a rube and they're going to try and take advantage of it? There's the pecking order aspect of that too.
But all of this is great. I mean, you're already teaching the courses aware. It's the kind of stuff that kind of discussion offers insight into legal negotiation and risk management you might not otherwise get. The purpose of this course, I thought, was to expose law students to future trends, to aspects of legal practice. So legal risk management is another one. I would have a session on that, and identifying, controlling, mitigating legal risk. Mm-hmm. Can I say, incidentally, just a matter of a conceptual point, that I wouldn't mix it up with substantive law, with the law relating to technology. I think that weakens its impact. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of compromise that I edit the International Journal of Law and Information Technology, and it's for 17 years been a compromise because we deal both with law relating to technology and the use of technology in the law. But I think at some stage we've got to have the guts to say that this field can live in its own. Exactly. It can live in its own. There's something
purity
we don't need to, we don't need, it doesn't need to have something substantively legal in it to qualify as learnable or worth learning.
You have a list of your 10 disruptive technologies.
Did you expect I can remember them? Let me have a go.
My question is actually not only remembering, but could we use them usefully as a template to think about what we would teach against that disruption, or in the context of that disruption?
Some would work well, and some would. I mean, one is document assembly. The second one is what I call relentless connectivity. And that's just this idea that whether it be through email or...
Does that tie back into the Web 2.0 stuff?
Well, I mean, it can do. Part of it is that. It's just the point that you can't get off the grid as a lawyer anymore. The idea of going in, if you're a sole practitioner, you can't really go on holiday without your BlackBerry. Mm-hmm. You are some form of presence, either of you personally or of your team, will increasingly be necessary online. Mm-hmm. There's a whole area of e-learning, which we haven't really talked. Well, actually, it has been mentioned, but e-learning is another area. Close client communities, I've mentioned. Open sourcing of legal materials, online dispute resolution, embedded legal knowledge.
Trying to think whether what would there be courses or other kinds of offerings to come out of that?
I mean, some of those would be case studies. I'd love to see some case studies on embedding legal knowledge. There's a good question was asked afterwards about that. If you start embedding legal knowledge in project management and process management, how does that something stultified the law. Interesting question.
Actually, that was the project management was something that resonated to me when you mentioned it. Mm. I teach at the Thayer School of Engineering at Dartmouth, a course called Law, Technology, and Entrepreneurship. Mm. One of the things they've taught me in return is the kind of systematized approach to a problem that a project manager would do. Not all legal projects would be susceptible to that, but lots might well be. And certainly if you're doing the technology, and you should be aware of some of that, and maybe even if not.
I mean, project management and workflow is another disruptive technology. It sounds ridiculous, but actually very few law firms actually do use project management and workflow systems.
Well, if you're just billing every hour, it doesn't matter how many you have.
That's the point.
It's like a voter saying, I'll take my time.
Yeah, that is exactly the point. Yeah. A lot of the disruptive technologies disrupt the hourly billing model. So that's another one. The electronic legal marketplace, which I mentioned, things like auctioning and reputation systems and price comparison systems for the selection of law firms. So another way out of cutting the whole the legal world is to say that there's three processes. There's a recognition, selection, and service. Mm. Recognition is the process by which people, either individuals or organizations, recognize they need some kind of legal help. Selection is the process by which they identify the best source of legal help. And the service bit's actually receiving the help. And a lot of access to justice problems are problems of recognition.
Yeah.
That very many ordinary citizens have no idea. They don't recognize that their circumstances are, in some sense, covered by the law. And often when they do recognize it, it's too late. And even when they do recognize it, they often don't know that that's something that is a useful online, or maybe a government website that can help them through. They often just assume they can't afford legal help. So there's I call that the client service chain. It's just a different way of, I throw it out just to see if it resonates, but it's just another way of looking at the legal process, because we're actually quite good at service delivery. We're not so good at helping clients recognizing they've got problems at the right time, and we're not so good at helping them identify the best way in their circumstances to take legal guidance.
Are there pieces of the traditional law of technology that would be, I know there's this, I think you said maybe don't combine them, but is there a you know, I mean, this is, John, I know this, the Harvard curriculum is that exists as a suggested curriculum of sort of law and technology has a number of courses in it that are perhaps of what we've been calling the more law of technology approach. Are there pieces of that we want to make sure we have? We want to make sure that they have IP and things.
There's
like
one subcategory that might justify an exception to Richard's rule. The law of the technology of law. So, for an example, the intellectual property in legal practice systems.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, so legal issues involving technological initiatives in law.
Yeah.
Unauthorized practice in law, those kind of questions.
Yeah, there are issues there, and the whole litigation for electronic disclosure is another area there.
Yeah,
electronic disclosure is interesting.
The very technology itself raises legal questions that are...
Yeah.
That help you understand the technology better.
Or the liability implications of, say, online advisory systems. That's another aspect. Yeah, I'm prepared if you imagine it as two intersecting circles.
There's
a bit of in common.
Privacy is one of those in them.
I'm trading off a minute. My elder son is on his way to Edinburgh this evening, and is here, and I need to consult him for just a moment.
But I'm merely recording.
What would we call these overlap areas? The kind of hybrid areas, in a way.
Yeah, the best. You know, there's the technology of the law. There's the law of technology. Then there's the law of the technology of law. I mean, this is one way to identify this.
Me too.
Overlapping circle.
I could legitimize the study in this course.
PARNOM.
That's true.
What do we know down there? So yeah, liability of online advice, I think, is another legal issue.
This is the law of the technology. Okay. So we have disclosure. We have unauthorized practice.
Liability of,
which I can tell you the California bar would be very vigorous in pursuing. And then we have liability.
Yeah, for non-conventional, loss of e-enabled advice.
Right.
Mark, you give almost like perhaps 30% of the course, your course proposal to things like that under the heading of ethics.
Yeah. I think that was mainly put in there just because it...
Well, they're a big obstacle.
Yeah.
The unauthorized practice is...
It's a huge issue.
It's a huge issue.
Yeah. An issue I quite like, I've talked over the past, is which goes back to the AI and law one, is what can judges do that computers can't? Mm. It's a great discussion to have with students, and it immediately gets them in unwittingly into fascinating issues of AI and of analytical jurisprudence as well.
Why not a computer judge? That,
yeah. Did we do judge. We do courts up here earlier?
Yeah, this is more reflective, I think. The courts one is understanding what technologies are possible and practicable today and likely in the future. This is more conceptual,
right?
Which is really talking, what's the limits of technology in the legal process? And I find no better way of doing that than focusing on the computer judge. Just put the computer judge. It can be struck off.
I'm going to put it in.
You can do it.
Because it's inevitable.
No, the discussion, the debate's not inevitable.
In Brazil, anyway.
The fact of it is going to be
inevitable.
Yeah,
Brazil's where it's going to happen.
Judges on wheels.
Maybe one of the reasons that we're having a renaissance of this is because the internet has found a way into technology that is not frightening. I think that fright and fear plays a huge role, and I saw that yesterday. We had somebody speaking to us on the whole law of strikes by the, what's the drone called? Predator drone. And the whole issue of, you know, killings by predator drones and all the law around that issue. And I think what disturbs, you know, there's snipers. We've had war a long time, but there's something about an automated robot that's being commanded to kill people that is this unstated elephant in the room is fear. And I think maybe that's one reason that we now have a whole generation that, you know, it wasn't the robot. It didn't come that way. It's the iPhone. It came that way. So
this is one thing that's maybe implicit in other ones, but the whole issue of lawyerless legal services, of pro se systems, self-representation. You know, is that a topic that law school should look at? How should such systems be designed to deliver systems through which people can help themselves?
How about litigation that comes afterwards about that and what judges are supposed to do with
it? How does the court system metabolize unrepresented litigants?
I don't know quite what the short version of this is, but certain disciplines like AI or computational biology are sort of self-aware that they're getting into things that raise legal issues, and they're beginning to sort of think about that and kind of trying to bridge or reach out or so I don't know what the right way to call that is.
Say more about that.
Well, for instance, the president of the Association for AI in the U.S., actually it's international, has a presidential panel thinking about certain kinds of issues about robots and unassisted interventions and reasoning and this and that.
Like that.
It's the ethics from the AI side. What should AI, be aware of its own ethics? But it crosses this boundary, and so you have people coming from the discipline side worrying about the ethics and the legal side. I mean, there's an interesting opportunity to kind of reach across that gap. And I'm sure people who do genomics and computational biology are worrying about the implications of, you know, what they're up to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the Predator was a primitive, primitive version of that.
Yes, yeah. And you know, that's what made me think of it. I mean, you know, if the AI technology spawned a robot that could make a decision and take on a target and then execute the target, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, what should the AI people think about doing about enabling that target or that methodology?
Particularly since this particular individual who was advocating, who used to work in the CIA General Counsel's office, was advocating a rather complex, hybridized sort of state of war versus human rights regime, which involved many human steps and intervention. If you had a robot making the decision, the face matched against a database, other information, and then making the command decision, well, where do you insert the human being? Yeah.
This is what I brought up in the context of how food stamps are now distributed.
Yes.
You know? And in terms of disciplines, another discipline to consider would be design. And I use the metaphor of video games often to talk about that issue. But how you design the system greatly changes the outcomes and inputs as you proceed through it. And a lot of times, it's not so much about the artificial intelligence as what I've been kind of thinking about is almost artificial emotional intelligence. Sure. You know, what's really innovative about access to justice isn't just that it takes the law, deconstructs it, and figures out how to do pro se filings of divorce papers, but that it walks you through it in a way that is designed for lay intervention, which is part of the role that we lawyers play is translating law so that humans can understand it, non-lawyer humans. And so we have to think about the design as part of that as well, not just the artificial intelligence.
No, I wasn't saying just.
No, I'm just saying
the AI people are worried about the implications of the technology they develop. But also when you talk about the design of systems, there are questions about is it biased to, you know, elevate certain groups and not others, gender, one thing, race, whatever. I mean, you know, there's a lot of implicit design assumptions that favor one constituency versus another.
Abled or disabled, yeah.
That's the question you got from that woman who was saying, as you know, when you were talking about embedded law, and she's saying, I mean, are you stifling?
Yeah.
Yep.
Good question.
Can you imagine an area in this number 23 that would slop over into and affect the main body of what we've been talking about?
Sure, so maybe this would be one. People are beginning to develop the technology to have robot assistance, for instance, in elder care situations. And so that ranges from, you know, things that monitor and intervene or call a real nurse when some situation is sensed, to actual robotic aids that come in and lift the patient out of the bed. So it seems to me the robotic or intelligent assistant in the monitoring of elder care.
Can I ask a question?
The law practice side of this has, and the liability created.
There's liability, there's ethics, there's business about practice, who should be practicing this. I mean, they're not practicing law, but are these robots practicing medicine?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Maybe a stupid question, but what I'm seeing is you're developing a whole course that really is getting broader and broader.
It's not an entire curriculum.
Well, okay, that's exactly my point. You're implicitly suggesting that the rest of the faculty can't deal with these issues. And I think what you're pointing out is that so much of law revolves around the use of information and how information is used. It used to be just the written word and the spoken word. Now it's something different, and now we have technologies that can do much more than simply store information or communicate information. So those things seem to me, David said, well, he has this program, but he won't run it by the faculty for approval because he doesn't want to have a war on his hands. On the other hand, maybe I can ask John a question. Because Harvard, and now has appointed, I heard this only 2 weeks ago, but I still can't get over it, that Harvard has appointed as a law as a director of a law library, somebody who's not a librarian. That strikes me as clearly stating that information is not simply in a building or a room called the library, but information pervades the whole curriculum. And that has the potential to be revolutionary, I think, perhaps more than any of this. But
my question for you all is, at this stage, do you want to shift gears a little bit? I'm sorry, I should let John respond. Then I will. Sorry.
Can't leave the one hanging.
Sorry.
I'm positive that there's a response other than to say, I hope I can live up to the...
I told them earlier, right? No, it's...
When you guys were talking about an entire curriculum that acknowledges the centrality of information to the study of law, it sounds like more or less my charter as vice dean of the Law School for Information. That's sort of what, you know, I'm seeking to do, and thinking about it not just as library as a place, but information as a function and service and materials and all sorts of other things that belong in the... right at the core of teaching and scholarship, which is the mission of the university and the law school in particular. So it sounds right, and you guys are doing what seems to me kind of a hack of the curriculum in this design that seems like it could be a lot of fun. I think the David Johnson response of, I'm not going to show my program to the faculty for fear of a war, is also legitimate in the sense that though I have a fairly broad mandate to do what you described, it's not a frontal assault on the legal academy. It's
well, that's exactly right. It's not a, I mean, Edwina and others told earlier what they were doing in the early 90s or late 80s. What I was doing in the early 90s was mostly talking with a handful of law school faculty, but mostly with law librarians. They were the ones at the time who had an appreciation of technology,
yeah.
But it was sort of clear they were going to miss the boat because they wanted the technology to stay in the law library. Now, they had an understanding about the value of information, but it was, you know, simply accessing information in an alternative to the books. But even that, they weren't willing to get rid of the books. And
we now have no choice because we're cutting our budgets. But,
but you know, a really... Yeah. Oliver and I were talking on the way down, sort of a viral approach. We stumbled on, really, the use of the Institute as a way of sort of creating a new locus for something. We have an energy institute, and it uses law students like graduate students, and it generates money, and it generates ideas and courses. There are now 7 energy courses, and I think other faculty are being pulled in because it's just there. You know, it's this locus.
How does it generate money?
It generates money because it finds $700,000 a year in clients who want it to do research. It's like a consulting firm with the students as the team. But
there's
it's
also some grant-based funding as well.
Yeah, grant-based funding as well, and it's got 2 faculty. But the I like it because it's not a law school model. It's more a graduate school model in a way. But I could see having an institute for, you name it. I don't know what the name would be.
Well, Harvard does, and we're sort of sitting in it at the moment. Right? But it is a model that in fact the Berkman Center has follows to some degree of getting money from the outside and kind of just doing its thing, and then when that thing spills over into the rest of the curriculum, it there you are.
Yes, so the only distinction here is we don't do any, you know, consulting work. We won't don't take. Exactly that, which is at the literal margin of the law school, now literal northern margin of the university, that the desire is to do the crazy stuff we can do safely in here and then have it kind of edge its way in through the acts of people who have tenure and can get away with it in the broader environment.
And one of the reasons why I posited this to the group as an LLM was to also detox it a bit from concern. You know, say, you know, imagine an LLM where we have some freedom to design, or not even LLM. We offer at Vermont again a very funny degree in law and environment. which is not ABA accredited.
The ABA doesn't care about the LLM. We can do whatever the hell we want. It's an environmental LLM. Nor does our academic dean give a damn. I mean, it's sort of kind of outside of, nor do we have to get ABA permission for changing it. We have to get sort of a kind of informal consent sometimes. They don't care.
So that strikes me as a venue where you could start doing some standardization of the legal advice giving in the energy and environmental area. Are you doing that?
But it's also just to push the LLM model. It's also all the courses, and if you put up courses in the LLM, you don't get the same, I don't know if this is true at Harvard, you don't get the same level of scrutiny as you do if you try to deal with a JD curriculum. But of course, JD students can take those courses.
So what kind of standardization are you doing? And are the law students involved in
standardization?
In Richard's sense. So
in the whacking the world up and making it easier to deliver the services.
No. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your standardization. But of these courses.
So it sounds like such an institute, though, would be a locus where
curriculum.
One could start to build standardized legal advice giving tools and techniques that you could involve law students in creating.
And the institute model was being brought up for two reasons. One, as it currently exists, is a place where some of that of our approaches could be incorporated. But also, one could set up such an institute as the Berkman Center, in fact, is. But an institute for the study of law and technology, or the technology of law. And the one thing that Berkman hasn't ever really done is offer an LLM. I mean, it doesn't do that. I don't know whether that's ever been discussed.
It has been. But we haven't done it.
And again, it may be easier at schools that don't have quite the same supertanker aspects as the Harvard Law School, but maybe not.
Seems to me there are. Sorry, go ahead.
I think there used to be some joint, or are there some joint programs, for instance, between Harvard Law School and a constituency, is at MIT or at other parts of Harvard? I mean, those.
That seems a natural.
We've taught one-off classes.
Kind of a joint institute or a joint program where it goes back to Kevin's point of, or maybe was it when it was intermixing computer science graduate students with law students in some of these courses.
At Berkeley they have an energy center that is, it isn't anywhere. I mean, it's everywhere.
It's a kind of a cross-disciplinary,
transdisciplinary. Totally transdisciplinary.
But that is precisely the design of the Berkman Center. I mean, computer science students and employers, social scientists.
That is.
And you meant, Gene, things at Stanford, right?
Yes. And that's partly because their university has a synced schedule, which we don't quite have here. Close.
Has a synced schedule.
Yeah, but it's all the schools, and they have a stronger university system. Whereas we are a little bit more confederate. Another model that I've often looked to as a way of how changes happen here is when I look at the negotiations program and how that got established. So you had Roger Fisher basically building an entire new discipline and getting it accepted so that it's now mainstream, whereas it wasn't decades ago. And I don't exactly know how he did it, but it did entail building up the scholarship, building up kind of an ecosystem so that there were places for the students to go if they wanted to become mediators or become negotiators.
It's a program on.
Yeah, it's a program on, but it's now an accepted part of the curriculum and been legitimized as such, and there's journals and all this entire, in a way that can be cognized by regular faculty rather than trying to get them to accept a completely different way of doing things.
It seemed to me a couple possible concerns about doing it as an LLM. One thing, I thought you were concerned with producing lawyers who understand and take advantage of this technology and can make use of it, and you're not going to do that through an LLM program. On the other hand, I think there's a risk that it's just going to be not very good computer science or whatever else. I mean, lawyers are, very good at getting into a lot of different fields and often in a not particularly professional matter. If you combine it with MIT, it's not likely to have that problem. But otherwise, I think there's a risk it's just going to be second-rate technology as opposed you have an LLM in tax law, you got to study tax law. You do what you do as a lawyer, and it's going to be a good, it's going to be presumably a good program if it's at a good school. If you're doing something other than law at a law school, you got to be careful about that.
I'd be interested in just one from the practitioner here in the room. You know, out of a larger size firm, what percentage of your firm body mass, or however you want to put it, could be composed of people who actually do this? I mean, can the people at the top afford to ignore this stuff and put that halfway down the firm chain of command, or do you need someone among your managing partners who really gets this stuff?
Well, of course, it depends on what this stuff is, but in general, the answer is it does not extend up particularly far, because people, you know, staff are hired, or a few lawyers deal with things as they become necessary. Electronic discovery is one area in which it shows when there is a real need in terms of the practice of law, then technology becomes involved. We've hired, you know, maybe I don't know, several people, and you know, and we're just a mid-sized firm at this point, about 230 lawyers, not big by today's thing, but you know, with that, it's clearly because of electronic discovery, technology has to play a role, and so we've hired people to do it, and people, you know, higher up in the litigation hierarchy are more aware of the need for it. They don't understand it themselves, but they know that we need people to do it. But not the general answer to your question is not real far.
That's restricting to technology. In my talk, I was talking about alternative ways of sourcing legal work. I was talking about outsourcing and offshoring and so forth. And certainly the firms I advise, which are one of the biggest firms in the world, that is absolutely now a boardroom issue.
It is now. It is.
And it wasn't, say, 3 years ago. But the pressure coming from the major corporates and the major financial institutions, that every one of the managing partners in the top 10 firms in London is completely engaged, has had serious discussions with private equity investment, has serious discussions with 2-3 more of the outsourcing providers. He's talking about subcontracting legal work, revamping paralegal. It may not be the technology side, but certainly what I call the alternative sourcing is now absolutely mainstream in the firms I see. You know.
I have a little anecdote from my own practice. When I was at a firm, I wanted to get a computer, and this was back in the 1980s, and I was turned down by my managing partner, and he said, "Lawyer fingers do not touch keys." So I'm not sure where, you know. Your point is that when the necessity hits, it often hits hard. We had all computers in 2 years later, but it was an interesting conversation.
Is there a sense where you can routinize the knowledge in such a way that it can be, for many circumstances, commoditized at some point in technology? That will happen.
Sorry, is there?
Is there a point where you can routinize the knowledge, which is sort of, to some degree, where it becomes commoditized, and then you compete on price? Is this sort of the because then when you get the fellows in the top 10 firms are juggling for market share, because at some point they're going to be competing against each other, and then who has the lowest cost is going to win. Sure, you'll have certain segments, it's not why, but do you see that happening in the law?
Yeah, but it's more subtle than that. If you take litigation, for example, you can divide litigation into various constituent parts. You can look at there is document review, there's document management, there's electronic disclosure, there's negotiation, there's tactics, there's advocacy, there's strategy, there's legal research and so forth. And my argument is that, and we're seeing this, is that the big firms have got to look hard at each of these components to see whether or not they're conducting each efficiently. Because if one firm goes to a client and say, "We can deal with this, here's how we handle this dispute, we outsource this bit, we computerize that, but we're better equipped to deal with electronic disclosure than the firm down the road. Document review, we do it at half the price because we outsource it over there. The legal research, we subcontract to." That's the way that
that firms are beginning to think. They need to modularize their work and compute in constituent tasks.
But then that would argue then that at some point there are going to be some modules, components that be commoditized and they get higher value services somewhere else. And if you're using Clay Christensen and his argument would be, you know, when you're the disruptor, is actually going to come out of another category.
Yeah.
And you see that as happening.
I mean, well, that's why I say that. That's why I think the private equity input is important, not for the very small number, relatively, of organizations they invest in, but for the indication to the profession that there's different ways one can work. Mm. And this is why I keep on stressing it's not just a UK issue. If we manage to set up legal businesses in the UK through private equity and external involvement of non-lawyers, just different sorts of businesses, that will have, I keep on saying, a ripple effect right across the world. Why would it not? Why would you want to be a chief executive in a company and know that there's techniques out there that are would have your legal fees?
It's like the newspaper industry. There's a whole culture.
It's like almost every other industry.
I mean, it will not. I mean, my experience in doing management consulting, strategy consulting, is these are not rational choices, and they walk right up the edge until the cliff is there. There's no, it isn't. And there they go. He didn't do it. It won't happen to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's predictable, and particularly when you've been so successful. And you have a whole social of status around that.
Yeah.
It just argues to me that it's going to come from someplace else.
I think that,
Walmart in medicine is going to be interesting. I mean, what they're getting, because they're going to have a cost structure that's going to be very, very, and streamlining efficiency at different kind of proficiencies. Same thing in law.
I think you'll also see a number of niche firms being set up with very senior partners from successful big firms start up new business and think, actually, we don't need the overhead, we don't need that gearing, we can have one associate, and we can, with his legal research involved, we can subcontract it there and so forth. So that's partly answers your question. It's not entirely different business. It's actually...
Right. Your specialization is
out of necessity, a lot of bright lawyers will regroup and organize themselves differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think the big firms that do lots of work that can be done in different ways are the firms that are most effective.
Well, may I redirect us briefly to practitioner training? That is a piece of this. Richard, you've maintained that practitioners are where a lot of the recognition of this need comes from. Is that a better locus for our efforts rather than thinking about a law school?
I don't see this. I'm sure you don't either. I don't see them as alternatives. That's another fertile area for us to discuss. But as I keep on saying, I think we'd be doing our students a disservice not at least allowing them the opportunity to some exposure to future possibilities. Now, practitioners are different set of insights altogether. And again, this is where David Wilkins and Ashish Nando's work comes in, where they really are helping people who run law firms think about their futures. So the case studies that go on from these guys are superb. And practitioners are really interested in being exposed to new thinking. I don't know if you know that Harvard runs this executive education for managing partners and senior partners and firms that get tremendously well attended and enjoyed. But a lot of that is to do with things like strategy and marketing and financial management and so forth, less to do with things like technology and future possibilities. So I would say it's a component missing rather than an entire gap.
I feel an energy breakdown coming. Why don't we take about 5 or 10 minutes, and then let's reconvene and kind of recap and figure out where we want to conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Next. We'll do that. Great. Okay.